It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. What does it take to be a master chef? Can you quantify this kind of perfection? The Culinary Institute of America thinks you can with their certified master chef exam. It makes the Olympic triathlon look like a stroll on the beach. Journalist Michael Ruhlman has seen the test in action, and he's got an inside report. The intrepid Stearns have found a little red hen in Chicago. We've got white salmon, the fish chefs are swooning over. We visit Tommy Smothers, the dumb brother who's become pretty smart about making wine. And we weigh in on the political scene. Alice Waters tells us her dream for the White House. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. Welcome to Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure. A practical guide for nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. Today I want to talk about custards because folks are usually intimidated by them. Whenever we have dinner at a fancy restaurant and someone orders a creme brulee or maybe something more unusual, like a first course of roasted garlic custard with lemongrass, they're in awe. Oh, I could never do that. Well, yes, you can. Because once you understand what a custard is and the few tricks that guarantee success, you'll see how you can take the basic concept of a custard and improvise. Let's start with the definition. What is a custard? Essentially, a custard is a liquid thickened by cooking with eggs. The liquid could be almost anything: milk, cream, wine, broth, coffee, fruit juice. Custards can be sweet or savory. They can be made on top of the stove or in the oven. Here are the secrets to a good custard. First of all, in a custard, you heat eggs to the point where they thicken. But if they get too hot, they firm up and you have scrambled eggs in liquid. Now, eggs are cooked, they're safe from salmonella, and they become firm enough to thicken when the custard is at about 165 to 170 degrees. You could go a little higher if there's a lot of fat in your recipe. The eggs curdle around 190. Obviously, an instant reading thermometer is vital here. Let's start with making stovetop custards. Emblazon the words, "keep stirring," in your brain. Heat at the bottom of the bowl or the pan is like a magnet for eggs. They want to go there and they want to scramble themselves. So check the temperature often. By the way, this is why Zabaione recipes have you whisking the mixture of marsala, eggs, and sugar constantly. Here's a basic formula for a pourable stovetop custard to serve with fruit or cakes or tarts. It's called creme anglaise. You want 4 eggs to 2 cups of half and half or milk. The sugar is more or less a half a cup. The flavoring's about 2 teaspoons of vanilla. To make the custard, whip the egg, sugar, and vanilla in a bowl. Warm the milk in a saucepan until bubbles form around its edge. Whisk a little of the hot milk into the eggs. This is called tempering. It warms the eggs gently with no chance of scrambling them, and it helps melt the sugar. Now gradually whisk in the rest of the milk. Pour everything back into the saucepan and set it over medium to medium-low heat. Stir constantly until the custard reaches a temperature of about 165 to 170 degrees. You're going to see that it thickens a bit. Pour it through a strainer. This guarantees a silken sauce. And cool it. You can keep it about 2 or 3 days in the fridge. With this basic formula and technique, you can make any stovetop custard. For instance, substitute some strong coffee for the milk and stir in a little melted chocolate at the end of cooking. By the way, the formula for that Italian Zabaione is equal parts of sugar, marsala, and egg yolks. You could substitute white wine or lemon juice for the marsala, and you have a totally new dish. You could chill the custard, it'll firm up, fold in whipped cream, and you'll have a dessert better than ice cream. Now to the next plateau, baked custard. Use that same technique of the heated milk whipped into the eggs and the flavorings. For a thicker custard, like creme brulee, use either heavy cream or more yolks. Now, when you're making savory custards, you can use a low-fat trick to thicken them. Add pureed starchy vegetables that have a lot of taste, like peas or sweet potatoes or fresh sweet corn. Of course, herbs and spices you can just go crazy with. Custards are baked in small or large dishes in a water bath. Here's how you do it. You have a roasting pan that'll hold your custard containers easily. Lay a folded kitchen towel in the bottom of the pan. Put the custard containers in it and add hot water to come about halfway up their sides. That's the water bath. It buffers the heat. Remember how those eggs love to go for the heat source? This is what protects them. Keep the heat low when you're baking, about 325 degrees. And the way you know the custard is done is that you slip the blade of a small knife halfway between the edge and the center of the custard. When the knife comes out clean, but the center is still jiggly, take the custard out of the oven. It's going to finish cooking in that hot water. So try a custard this week and join us again for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by the kitchenware area at Target, where you'll find a complete assortment of fondue sets, including the Farberware Commercial Fondue, featuring an 1810 stainless steel fondue pot, jewel-tone color-coded forks, and black ceramic ramekins. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions, and it is distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Well, today we've got a study of perfection, at least an attempt at quantifying perfection. In this case, it's about what it takes to be a master chef. According to the CIA, that's the Culinary Institute of America, it's about passing their certified master chef exam. Our guest, journalist Michael Ruhlman, has seen the test firsthand. He says it's 10 grueling days of unrelenting challenge. And he has some thoughts on why two-thirds of the pros who take it fail. Hey, we have got a better bet than the NASDAQ. It's a new commodity, a mystery fish. It's white salmon. The mystery is folks don't seem to know exactly what it is, but it's gone from practically trash to pure gold. White salmon sells for $20 a pound. Chefs are fighting over it. And we've got a scientist who's solving all the mysteries. Remember the Smothers Brothers, the controversial comedy team of Tommy the Dumb Brother and Dick the Smart One? Well, Tommy's become a pretty smart winemaker. Reporter John Kalish pays a visit to the Smothers Brothers Winery. Alice Waters is back with help for the new president. The queen of American cuisine and creator of Chez Panisse restaurant in Berkeley has a brilliant idea with incredible spin potential. Then, as always, in the second half of the show, we're opening the lines for your calls. The number's 800-537-5252. Well, Jane and Michael Stern are stepping up to the mic. They write the road food column in Gourmet magazine.
Lynn, we've been to Chicago and we found something wonderful to eat other than a hot dog.
I can't believe this, Michael. You and Chicago hot dogs, you never eat anything else but hot dogs when you are in Chicago.
Don't get too excited, Lynn, because what we found is an incredible bakery. And what I'm thinking is Michael has now found bread and will figure out a way to put a hot dog on it.
Au contraire, madame. The only thing a hot dog belongs in is a Rosen's poppy-seeded bun. But we're talking about a bakery here, so we'll talk about something else.
This is a place. It's called the Red Hen Bakery at 1623 North Milwaukee in Chicago. And it was a great find that we were not prepared to even go restaurant or bakery hunting. We were chasing out in the early morning to O'Hare Airport, and literally we took our own advice, which is in our car, we rolled down the windows, and the smell coming from this bakery of fresh baked bread and yeast and just, well, you know how nothing smells better than baking bread, stopped our car cold in its tracks. And we found a parking space, ran in, and probably bought enough bread to last us for the, you know, for Y2K number three or two.
And ate most of it on the way to the airport, too. The thing about the Red Hen is that Nancy Carey, who runs it, has this love of baking and love of bread that expresses itself in the name of the place. Red Hen some of the older people in our audience may remember, as I do, is the name of a golden book about a hen who wants everyone to help her do the baking, cut the wheat, make the bread. Nobody has time to help her, but when the bread is baked, everybody wants to eat it. And that's kind of the story of Nancy Carey. It's not a one-man operation. She has plenty of people working in the bakery, but once this bread is baked, everybody wants a piece of it.
Nancy also has flaming red hair, so when we met her, I just assumed she was the red hen because, you know, of this fiery Maureen O'Hara kind of, you know, beautiful flowing hair she has. But she said that it's about the work ethic of making bread. And tell you.
Let's be specific.
Yes, let's be specific.
Can we just tell you a few of the kinds of bread that you can expect?
Sure, sure.
It's
absolutely always
different. Well, there are always some rugged sourdough loaves, some peasant breads. There are these great kind of circular loaves topped with caramelized onions kind of pressed into the top of the loaf. There are wreath-shaped loaves that are infused with an olive tapenade. There's this incredible kind of pumpkin, sweet corn, multi-grain bread that we actually managed to get home with us and make toast from that was just spectacular.
And my two favorites, which are only made on the weekend, and that is a bittersweet chocolate chunk bread, which you can toast and have for breakfast, and a sweet potato pecan loaf. Oh, and not only is the food great, and Nancy is a wonderful person to talk to about food, but she had just finished repainting the bakery, and it looks like a 1940s candy box when you walk inside. It's bright pink. It's almost like opening a children's book from the 1940s. Everything is beautiful primary colors, neat as a pin, and, you know, with this kind of like jewel box effect of these fabulous loaves of bread set out, you know, on the display counter. Not what you want to leave to go sit on a smelly airplane afterwards.
Can you actually eat there? I mean, can you get coffee or something and actually sit there and have some bread?
You can stand there and eat bread. There's nothing to drink. No, this is strictly a takeout bakery.
Mm-hmm.
And we should mention also, in addition to the breads, that Nancy makes really beautiful muffins. Wonderful. There was a mocha bittersweet muffin that we got.
And a banana date muffin that had dried date chips in it, which I tried to convince myself was health food.
It is health food.
It is, Jane.
So
it absolutely is. This is health food. Bread is health food. It's good for
bread
us.
Bread is good for us.
Yes, I won't be winter kill if I eat this.
Well,
I will be a robust-looking girl.
So it's the Red Hen Bakery. It's in Chicago, and we can cater our own plane flight by stopping there on the way to the airport.
A wise idea.
Okay. Hey, thanks.
Take care, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
If you're feeling fancy free, come wander to the world with me. And any place we chance to be will be our rendezvous. Two for the road.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Square Meals, America's favorite comfort food cookbook. They're here every week, and every week you can get their food finds on our website at splendidtable.org. Upscale restaurants in New York City and around the country have discovered something that Northwesterners have known about for quite a while. The new darling of innovative chefs is the white salmon. Reports have it that the fish is ivory-colored and is utterly luscious, buttery-tasting, sweet, extremely delicate. Now, it used to go just to the cannery or the smokehouse. Now you have to pay $20 a pound if you can find it. But what exactly is white salmon? Depending on who you ask, you get a lot of conflicting answers. We are going to a scientist who has studied the fish. Dr. Ruth Whiffler is a molecular genetic scientist at the Canadian Department of Fisheries and Oceans in British Columbia. Ruth Whiffler, welcome.
Hello.
So what exactly is white salmon?
White salmon is just a form of what you would call Tai salmon, in Canada referred to as Chinook salmon or spring salmon, one of the five species of salmon that swims back into the streams on the west coast of North America. And it's pretty much a regular king salmon, except for one, what turns out to be major difference, and that is that it doesn't put the pigments, the carotenoid pigments, into its flesh the way red Tahi salmon and all the other four species of Pacific salmon do.
There's one thing I'd like to clarify for myself. You refer to this whole family of salmon as Tahi salmon. Does that embrace the sockeye, the king?
No.
All right.
The king, sorry, I'm calling it a Tahi, thinking that's the American term, but your term is the king salmon. Okay, so it can, in Canada, it's got a variety, but that's just a single species. Okay, so it can be called the king, the Tahi, the Chinook, or the spring. Those are all the same species. Those are all the same fish. And that's the only, of the five species that are here, that's the only one that comes in red and white. Everybody else is red.
Okay.
To varying degrees.
Is there any specific thing in the flesh of the salmon or in the makeup of the salmon that gives it that taste? It has that very buttery, delicate flavor?
I'm not an expert on the chemistry. What the pigments do for the salmon, according to a chemist that I know that's up on this, is that the pigments are very strong antioxidants. So they perform the same kind of function as the pigments that we pick up when we eat spinach. And as the salmon return up the rivers, it's a fairly arduous migration in many cases. They don't eat. They survive by metabolizing lipids that they've collected and stored during their ocean migration.
Mm-hmm.
And that burning of the lipids produces a lot of free radicals, basically metabolites that aren't very beneficial to have hanging around in the flesh. And so it's the antioxidant function of the carotenoid pigments that deals with those free radicals. So there is likely a different fat composition in those fish that produces that very mild flavor that people notice when they eat the white salmon.
Is it a plentiful fish?
It's not particularly plentiful. On average, in catches in southern Alaska,
mm-hmm.
in a study done there, they represented about 10% of the Tahi salmon catch.
So they're not the easiest thing in the world to find and get.
You can't find them per se, in that a fisherman doesn't know what he's catching. There's no, especially when the fish are caught in the ocean, they're still silver bright. None of the pigmentation shows on the outside of the fish then, as it does later when they're spawning. So basically, the fisherman, when he's catching a Chinook salmon, doesn't know until it's opened up whether he has a red or a white-fleshed salmon. But how a white Chinook, you know, salmon fresh fillet ever ended up in New York is beyond me. But obviously when it did, it was a big hit.
Well, obviously it sounds as though novelty meets up with good flavor.
Oh, I think novelty is a big part of it. I've eaten white Chinook salmon, and you know, it may taste a little bit better than red Tahi salmon, but nobody out here would compare it to a sockeye salmon, for example. I think there's a bit milder flavor there, and if you don't come from eating, you know, salmon, you know, you're more used to eating a freshwater fish, for example, then I think that mild flavor is really, really appealing.
A fascinating fish. Interesting. Doctor, thank you.
You're welcome.
Dr. Ruth Whitler is a molecular genetic scientist with the Canadian Department of Fisheries and Oceans in British Columbia. Coming up, the Iron Man Challenge of the Food World and making wine with the Smothers Brothers. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Rosetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. There is a test in the food world that's the equivalent of the Olympics triathlon. It's the Certified Master Chef exam given by the Culinary Institute of America, known also as the CIA. Now, this is one of the country's top professional training schools. Author Michael Ruhlman went there to write a book about becoming a chef. In the process, he got hooked. He went through the school's year-long program. Then he went back to look at this test of chefs. The result is his new book, The Soul of a Chef, The Journey Toward Perfection. Michael Ruhlman, it's good to have you back.
It's good to be here, Lynn. Thanks.
Michael, you're going to have to explain to us exactly what this Certified Master Chef exam is about.
The exam is a 10-day long cooking test, a food knowledge test, a food skills test. For 10 days, chefs take actual written tests, give presentations, but mostly cook really hard in all different kinds of styles of cooking. They take practical cooking tests, nutritional cooking, American regional cooking, mystery basket or market basket cooking, where they don't know the ingredients beforehand and have to devise an elaborate menu given what they find in their refrigerator, classical cuisine, all done under great stress with a little sleep, for, as I said, 10 days. It's a very intense test, and they're graded at each step of the way. They're graded in the kitchen by proctors who are walking around these large teaching cook kitchens, and then they are graded by the judges who taste their food and evaluate it and then bring the candidate in and sit down and critique his meal and give him an actual number grade on this test.
I was amazed to read that there were proctors actually looking at the garbage to see the waste.
That's an important part. One of the important pieces of cooking in restaurants, is how much waste. The less waste, the better. The more you put to use, the better a cook you are. And so they have to evaluate the garbage.
So what's a typical day like in this test?
A typical day would be a chef gets up at 7 o'clock, or arrives at the CIA at 7 o'clock, takes a, say, sanitation course where they discuss sanitation, and they give a presentation on sanitation so that the sanitation instructor knows that they have a comprehensive knowledge of good food sanitation and good restaurant sanitation. Then they would take a short break, and then they'd be in the kitchen cooking, and they'd cook for the next 5 hours. And then they'd sit around for 2 hours. Perhaps they'd cook American regional that day.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd open up the refrigerator. They'd find two rabbits on their tray, a pound of scallops, some kidney beans, some Texbody rice, and they'd have to devise a menu, give it to the proctor within a half an hour, and then would have 4 hours to cook that meal for 10 people.
So tell me, how many people pass?
About a third of the people pass, 1 in 3. So far, only about 150 have taken this test.
Mm-hmm.
It costs thousands of dollars. It takes you away from your work for 10 days, during which you don't get to relax from your work. You have to work even harder than you've ever worked in a strange kitchen. It demands a lot of these chefs, financially, time-wise, and energy-wise. So why they take it is often it's a personal challenge. It comes down to a personal, I want to see if I can do it. I want to see what I'm made of.
So why the interest in this?
My interest initially was just, one, it's fascinating. Why would these people do this? It's so hard. Second, it has a funny claim, an interesting claim. It says that great cooking can be measured objectively without regard to anybody's standards, that great cooking can be given a number grade. And I wanted to see how that was done. And yes, I think it can. I think great cooking can be measured to an extent objectively. Is this piece of meat done perfectly? Has it been seasoned perfectly? Have they done these basics correctly all along the way? And the third part is, what are those basics? What are the fundamental elements of especially classical technique? and to watch how all these classical techniques are built upon one another to create a great finished composition. Here's an example of what a moment of this test is like, and why it is so intense and important to be focused at every step. Brian Polson, a chef in Michigan, was creating a classical menu. One of the items was a chicken sauté, Poulet Stanley, it's called, in which he has to make a bechamel-based sauce. At the first thing he did was to get his bechamel going, because he knew he had to cook that out. It's a milk-based, flour-thickened classical sauce. It can be a great sauce. People denigrate bechamel. It should not be denigrated. It can be a terrific sauce if it's done right. He started cooking out the flour early and then got to work butchering all the chickens and going on to the other stuff. But his problem was he let the bechamel early in the day get too thick, and so he had to turn the heat down. And by turning the heat down and over-thickening it, he couldn't cook out the flour. And so when he went 4 hours later to finish his sauce, it was still a little pasty. It had that floury taste to it. Nothing he could do. After he made that one mistake earlier in the day, there was no way that he could recover. Multiply that decision and that skill of making this one test by 1,000, and you have an idea of all the things that are going on during that test and the ramifications of making one wrong move early in the game.
So, did he pass?
This was the second time that Brian took this test. He failed classical the first time out, and that was his downfall. And again, the second time, it proved to be his downfall.
And he failed the test?
A second time. He intends to go back again. They are madmen.
Michael, thank you.
Thanks, Lynn.
Journalist Michael Ruhlman's book is The Soul of a Chef, The Journey Toward Perfection. The Smothers Brothers are one of the last surviving comedy teams. They've been making audiences laugh for over 40 years. But the thing you might not know is that for nearly as long, they've been making some highly regarded wines in California. Reporter John Kalish, who still has his Smothers Brothers fan club membership card from 1967, recently visited Tom Smothers at his winery in Northern California. A bit of a warning, by the way, adult language is used.
Since they made their debut as a comedy duo in 1959, the Smothers Brothers have mined a fictional sibling rivalry.
My mom always liked my brother best, and she never liked me. Mom and...
The clean-cut brothers were unlikely recruits in the counterculture of the late 1960s. They starred in the groundbreaking Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour on CBS television, but lost the popular variety show after a number of clashes with CBS brass over controversial material. Of course, Tom Smothers' image as the dumb one and Dick Smothers' role as the responsible one were just stage personas. Tom is 60 years old today and seems in excellent physical shape as he conducts a tour of the Smothers Winery in Kenwood. Tom Smothers explains it is his younger brother Dick he has to thank for two of the enduring passions in his life, playing golf and making wine.
My brother started a winery in Santa Cruz. 1977 was the first harvest. And 1978, he won a bunch of medals. And at the time, we were in New York. When we came back, he said, plant. So I had this property, so I started ripping it apart and putting the grapes in it. And 10 years after he did it, married a woman from the East Coast and went away, and he says, hey, you take it over. So I'm the farmer and the vintner now.
Tom Smothers has 40 acres of hillside land planted in rural Sonoma County north of San Francisco. With the help of his sister Sherry, Smothers picked rocks from the soil by hand, plowed the land, and put new grape plants in, what the vineyard owners call rootstock. On the day in early November that the Merlot grapes were picked, A dozen field hands worked rapidly, cutting the fruit off the vine with curved knives and tossing the clusters of grapes in a plastic gondola that holds about 2 tons. Because of microbial pests, new rootstock, most likely Cabernet, will be planted on the 4 acres devoted to Merlot.
We just sit around, drink wine, listen to guys talk, and you talk about every type of trellising that you can be, the Hungarian trellis and all this kind of stuff. And then you talk about rootstock, what kind of rootstock, and after about 20 years, you talk like you know what you're doing. And the conversation, you learn something along the way. So I know a little bit.
The Smothers Winery will make just 500 cases of wine this year. Most of it will be sold at the Wine Room on Highway 12, a tasting room run cooperatively by a handful of local boutique wineries. Among the Smothers wines on the tasting room menu is a $17 Chardonnay, a $32 Merlot, and a $45 Cabernet Sauvignon. But 3/4 of the Smothers Winery grapes are sold to Dick Arrowood, a local winemaker who uses them for his own label. This year, the grapes went for $3,000 a ton.
It's much more difficult to plant them on hillside. It's hard to get a hand pick everything, worry about the tractors falling down the slopes and stuff like that. You get not near the tonnage per acre. Down in the flats, they can get like 5, 6, 7, 8 tons per acre. We'll get 3 and 4. Five, but you're paid a lot more because these are the prime grapes. For some reason, they grow smaller. It's harder for them to grow, and a little more intensity in the fruit. So, looking for the prime grapes, the wineries invariably will pay a higher price for hillside grapes.
Tom Smothers likes to joke that in the Napa Valley they grow auto parts, but in the Sonoma Valley they grow wine. He has an unexpected metaphor for describing the particular spot in the Sonoma Valley where his vineyards are located.
I call it the clitoris of the valley.
What?
The clitoris of the valley. And people say, huh? But it aptly describes the spot it's in. Right to the west is the Mayacamas Range, and to the other side are Sonoma Mountain, and we are right in the center of it, and it's a little microclimate right in the center of this valley.
Initially, the wine Tom Smothers and his brother Dick made bore a label that said Smothers in prominent type. But they eventually found that the cachet the family name has in the entertainment world doesn't necessarily hold the same weight in the wine world.
People say, God, you have a winery. You had a vineyard. Man, I've always wanted to have one. Man, what do you call your, what do you call it? And I said, Smothers Brothers. They go, wow. Oh, geez. Their face drops. They go, man. They're hoping it'll be La Catopunpoite to put a vineyard.
So now the Smothers Vineyard wines are sold under the name Remick Ridge, in honor of the Smothers brothers' maternal grandfather, Ed Remick. He helped raise the brothers when they were boys and spent his final years living on Tom Smothers' ranch in Sonoma.
We cremated him. We didn't cremate him. The state does it, but we cremated him. Then we put his ashes in the drip system. And so there's a little bit of wisdom in the... In every bottle of Remick Ridge, and that's why it's so important to call it Remick Ridge.
Of course, Tom Smothers is just pulling your leg about the ashes in the drip system, just as he's putting you on when he gestures to hundreds of thousands of acres of neighboring vineyards and declares they're all part of the Smothers spread, when in fact they belong to Kundi, one of the biggest growers in the Sonoma Valley. Though he always lives up to his reputation as a funny man, his business card reminds you of his other vocation. It says simply, Tom Smothers, Farmer. The Remick Ridge Chardonnay this reporter sampled, which is described in company literature as creamy butterscotch with pear, is a testament to the fact that, ultimately, Smothers takes his job as a vintner quite seriously. For The Splendid Table, I'm John Kalish in Kenwood, California.
With luck, you can find Smothers Brothers wines in your local wine shop. If you're looking for John Kalish, he's the KCRW Gracie Films Radio Arts Fellow.
Hello. How'd you get my number?
Tell the one who loves you only. I can be so warm and tender. Call me. Don't be afraid. You can call me. Maybe it's late, but
the best time.
Tell me and I'll be alright.
Now is the best time. We are opening the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. Give us a call. We will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We've got Babette on the line. So, Babette, what would you like to talk about?
All right, Lynn, I have the big question here. I have been quite intrigued by preserved lemons, you know, the Moroccan thing that people do. So I've made some following a recipe that I got out of a magazine, and they're sitting on top of my refrigerator in the brine, but the top of the brine has gotten really cloudy. Should I be worried about them?
Oh, I thought you that they were sitting there. You didn't have a clue of what
well,
you're going to do
next.
With them.
Okay. I don't know if I'm going to kill myself with them before I get to cooking them.
Okay, let's. I think we better explain to everybody what we mean by preserved lemons. These are Moroccan or North African, and you preserve them in a lot of salt and water, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're whole lemons, and you make little. You can make little cuts in them if you want
them.
To. Yeah.
Right.
And the idea is you let them sit there. How long did you have to let them sit?
6 weeks.
6 weeks. Okay. That scummy look, if you'll pardon mm-hmm. the expression, such an attractive food term, mm-hmm. really has no problem to it.
Okay.
Now, if you see any mold, then you've got a problem.
Okay. Because they're floating now. You know, they used to be submerged, and now they're floating.
Yeah, well, they're completely permeated now.
Okay.
Yeah.
So now what do I do with them?
Ah. Well, first of all, one of the great dishes coming out of Morocco is roasting or stewing chicken with slices of preserved lemon. What you want to do is you take a whole chicken, you rub it with lots of garlic and a whole bunch of fresh coriander that you've just chopped up. And you rub that into the chicken with a little black pepper and maybe 10 garlic cloves that you've crushed and stick it in the fridge overnight and forget about it. Okay?
Okay.
Then the next day, spread out those pieces of chicken if you want on a roasting pan or you can put them in a stew pot. You can do it either way. Sprinkle them with coriander and cumin and a little bit of sweet paprika.
Great.
It's wonderful. And then what you do is you either roast them like at 375 or 400, or you brown them real slow in a big shallow pan mm-hmm. until they're really browned. And you start adding a little water or broth to that pan. And then you take a whole preserved lemon, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Cut it in half. Take out the pulp.
So I'm taking out the fruit part, actually.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. Cut up the skin into strips.
Uh-huh.
All right? And just scatter that over the chicken and keep roasting or braising the chicken, basting it with juices. I found if you cook that lemon with the chicken through the entire cooking process, it takes over.
Okay.
But if you add it the last half of the cooking time or the last third of the cooking time, mm-hmm. you're in good shape.
Okay, God, that sounds great.
It's wonderful. You serve that with couscous.
Okay.
Ah, unbelievable.
And does it go with lamb? Could I do it with lamb?
You can do exactly the same recipe with lamb. You can also do lamb with fruit, like dried apricots mm-hmm. in that mix. Roast the lamb with it and the preserved lemon. And the play of the tart sweet apricots against the salty sour lemon. This is really beautiful eating.
How long will they keep now? Forever?
Oh, boy. I have some I've kept for at least 8 months.
Okay. I'll give them out as gifts.
Well, you could. Yeah, they just have to be covered with their brine. And one of the things I do, just because I'm compulsive obsessive, is I keep throwing more salt in there. It's just me.
Okay.
It's one of the ways you make sure they stay okay.
I may not go that far.
You don't have to.
Okay.
Hey, thanks,
Babette. All right, thanks.
Goodbye. It's time for the trivia question of the week. Now, this one's a test of your knowledge of tableware and nonsense poetry. The question is, what's a runcible spoon? Do you remember the poem, The Owl and the Pussycat? You know, they went to sea in a beautiful pea-green boat and so on. And then they dined on mints and slices of quince, which they ate with a runcible spoon. So, what is a runcible spoon? We'll be back with that answer. More of your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. And we'll talk with Alice Waters, who has a project for the next president. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Thank you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We'll get back to your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. The question tests your knowledge of tableware and nonsense poetry. I asked, what is a runcible spoon? Well, if this rings a faint bell, it's probably because you recall the term from a poem by Edward Lear, The Owl and the Pussycat. Remember? They went to sea in a beautiful pea-green boat. Then Lear tells us that the owl and the pussycat decide to marry, and to celebrate, he says, they dined on mince and slices of quince, which they ate with a runcible spoon. Well, that was back in Victorian times. The Victorians might have originated the idea that the one who dies with the most stuff wins. They managed to create a specialized eating utensil for every imaginable kind of food. So a runcible spoon was made to serve hors d'oeuvres. It's a cross between a wide tablespoon and a fork. It's got two broad prongs and one sharp curved prong. Now, if I had a runcible spoon, I know the hors d'oeuvre I'd serve with it. Oven roasted tomatoes. I'd spoon them onto some crusty country bread. Now, the secret of this recipe is you use canned tomatoes, not those crummy fresh Romas. And it's so good and it's so easy. So you can get my recipe for oven roasted tomatoes on our website at splendidtable.org. The runcible spoon, that one I can't help you with. Okay, let's get back to the phones. The number's 800-537-5252. We've got Kathy on the line. So, Kathy, what do you want to talk about?
Hi. I have been trying to reproduce a wonderful, very, very simple tomato recipe I had years ago in France. And my husband and I are great gardeners. We grow lots of food, and we try lots of different ways to fix tomatoes. But this tomato, it's so simple, and it sounds so simple, it's embarrassing to describe it, but it was a perfectly round, small tomato served as like a side dish, and it was peeled, it was whole and firm, but it was warm. And floating in the center of this small tomato was a perfect poached egg. It was delicious. It was wonderful. We had it with steak and potatoes at a little roadside diner under an arbor. You know, and it was so simple, and it was so good. And I've tried preparing this. I've tried poaching the tomato, and it falls apart. I've tried just, you know, quickly dipping the tomato, blanching it to peel it, and it doesn't seem to have the right texture. And these are really good garden fresh tomatoes.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can't get the poached egg, regardless of how I core the tomato or take part of it out, I can't get it to float on top. It sinks. And so it's a silly question, but it was so good, and I'd love to be able to fix it, and I haven't had any success.
You know something? I don't think it's a silly question, and I think it's a trap in a funny way, that the things that are so incredibly simple seeming become incredibly difficult to duplicate.
Right.
And I've had this happen with dishes. I'm embarrassed to tell you what they might be. When you say, though, that the egg seemed to float, was the tomato cored out so that it was like a cup, or was it just gently hollowed so that the egg had a little bit of a dished-in area to sit on?
I think it must have been just gently hollowed, because when I've tried coring it, it sinks. When it's gently hollowed, that's, I think, the time that I first tried poaching the tomato.
I understand, because this is what I'm wondering, is that maybe what you might want to try... The warm part has me a little puzzled, but you may want to try very gently. Do you have a gas flame on your stove?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Instead of dropping the tomato or putting the tomato into water, I would just very gently expose that skin to the flame until it lightly puckers.
Oh.
so that you don't change the interior of the tomato and you have a minimum effect on heating the flesh. Because something happens to a fresh tomato. There is a never-never land with a fresh tomato between being cooked through and being heated that I think every flavor in it goes flat. You lose a great deal. So if you just use that gas flame to just lightly pucker the skin will slip off.
This is amazing. And this never, ever occurred to me.
Well, this is you're talking to a woman who unfortunately or fortunately is obsessed by tomatoes. And, you know, I mean, if you could talk to a tomato, I would have done that and had recorded it. But the other thing I'm thinking is, I wonder if your egg is too large, that's just an aside.
Oh, okay.
And maybe you might want to use a medium or a small egg. And what did it taste like? Did it taste like there was a sauce or a marinade or anything like that?
Maybe just a little salty.
Salty. Okay. Because one of the things that occurred to me, I've had something similar in France, where a very light vinaigrette, you know, minced shallot, vinegar and oil and salt and pepper, had been drizzled into a tomato that just had the top third scooped out as though a crater. It looked like a volcano.
Okay.
And if you did that and you put a medium-sized poached egg in there and you worked fast and had it warm from the warm part is getting me puzzled here.
It may have been the warmth of the day, and I'm thinking it was warm.
Or that the egg itself was warm, because you could freshly poach that egg or even rewarm the egg after you've poached it, and you're in business. But try the peeling, as I've suggested. Very brief exposure to the flame. And then if you want to flavor the tomato, salt it, obviously.
Right.
You know, salt and pepper it. But if you want to just drizzle a teeny bit of a nice vinaigrette so it goes into the chambers, essentially. And then put a smaller poached egg on top and see what happens.
This sounds good. I will do this.
And let us know how it works out.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for calling.
Bye.
We've got Judy calling. So, Judy, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I love your program. I'm in Los Angeles, and we're so happy that KPCC is carrying it.
Hey, thanks.
I was recently in Spain, and I went to the Landa Palace in Burgos, and they served a really interesting dessert of Manchego cheese, I believe that was the name of it, with sugared walnuts and a kind of a fig marmalade.
Oh, yeah. That sounds so good.
Oh, and then, you know, with a kind of a nut bread, and it was just fabulous. But can we even buy Manchego cheese here?
You know, if you've got a good cheese store in the area, they may carry it. But do you know that the area around Burgos also is well known for a fresh cheese that is just called queso, meaning cheese of Burgos?
Would it be like the Mexican queso fresca?
You know, I've never tasted it, so I don't know.
It's almost like a kind of a little bit tangy cottage cheese that's been made into a lot.
Yeah, it's very fresh then,
but
right?
The other thing I didn't know is I cannot find a fig marmalade or a recipe for it anywhere.
Well, let's see now. You know, never having tasted the one you tasted,
right.
I may be up a creek a bit, but there's this incredible tradition of preserving and playing with figs in the Mediterranean.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that I just came across in the Williams-Sonoma catalog a fig cake. Now, it's not a cake in the sense of a baked cake. It's a cake in the sense of figs flavored with green anise and I think lemon packed together into a cake form, dried figs, with almonds.
We can actually, at the farmer's markets here, buy fresh figs that are in a cake.
You know, you Californians make me crazy. So jealous. I haven't seen a fresh fig. You know, fresh figs get to Minnesota. They're put on display at the train station or at the airline terminal, you know, like the crown jewels, and then they disappear.
We actually have a fig tree in our backyard.
Oh, all right. Now you're, Judy,
but
now you're pushing it.
Could I take a regular marmalade or a stewed fruit recipe and use that?
Yeah, you could. And what you also could do is, wouldn't it be interesting to do a mix of fresh figs and dried figs and cook them with a bit of honey?
Cooked with honey, oh boy.
Yeah, cook them with honey and maybe a little white wine and some zest of lemon because you need that nice piquant quality to it. And that's your fig marmalade. But, you know, you've got fresh figs. You know the other thing you could do? I mean, and it's so good, is you open them up. You know, so you cut them in quarters so that they fan out, kind of like a rose.
Uh-huh.
Okay, take some fresh fennel seed or whole fennel seed and just pound it in a mortar and pestle until it's, you know, broken up.
Yeah.
And then sprinkle those figs with that fennel seed. Drizzle them with honey and balsamic vinegar. Honey and balsamic vinegar. Now, I would imagine a woman who has her own fig tree. Do you have your own bay leaf tree, Judy?
We don't, but we have rosemary, which is like a weed.
Yeah, that's, you are in California. Yeah,
yes,
it's
sure
a ground
are.
Cover there, and me, you know, I have four stalks growing in my kitchen.
It's just great. It's the land of milk and honey.
Absolutely. But you could use a few sprigs of rosemary or a few leaves of bay. But the idea is you put those in a shallow pan with the balsamic and the honey. Not a lot, just a light drizzle. And the fennel. And again, a little bit of the zest of lemon. And you bake it in a 325 degree oven until they begin to caramelize. And you serve that with a fresh cheese of any kind. And those walnuts and the nut bread.
Don't you think that's great?
I think it's the greatest idea. I'm going to be serving it. Thank you. This is going to be a party thing for
anytime.
Me.
Anytime. Thank you.
Hey, Judy, thanks.
Bye.
Goodbye. Doesn't that sound like a dessert? I mean, once you've got the figs taken care of, you just buy the cheese. You could probably use one of those loaves of, you know, multigrain bread with nuts in it and raisins in it. What a great dessert. There's one other thing I would do. You could drizzle the fresh cheese with a little bit of good honey. And just set that out and let everybody help themselves. Oh, good idea for this time of year. Okay. We've got our own particular take on the political maelstrom of the last month. We figure that this new administration is not going to have an easy time of it. So we've got a suggestion. Pick a project that's not going to be hard to do. One that comes to mind is a suggestion from Alice Waters. Alice Waters is the creator of Chez Panisse Restaurant in Berkeley, California, and she's, I guess, what you would call the patron saint of the movement for local, organic, and sustainable foods. We have her on the phone. Alice, good to have you back.
Thank you very much.
So, now, tell me what you've been plotting for the White House.
Well, I have felt that we need to have a sort of a living symbol of the presidency's commitment to the environment and to just an understanding of nourishment and how vital it is to the quality of our lives, our good health, and to the health of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have imagined that there could be a vegetable garden planted on the White House lawn. And this vegetable garden would be that living symbol. I know that it has lots of precedents from Versailles and gardens that were planted there, the huge potager, the vegetable garden.
Now, have you suggested this to the Clinton administration?
I have suggested it. I wrote him a letter.
And what happened?
I have the feeling that they didn't quite understand what I had in mind, because their response was that they believe in this and that they have some vegetables growing on the roof of the White House and there is a compost heap a couple blocks away. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a place that is really a part of the whole experience of going into the White House, that just the way that the Rose Garden might be.
Well, it sounds practical in what I'm picturing, and it would be an organic garden, right?
And, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm picturing that now the president will hold news conferences in the radish patch. and that's a great idea.
A really incredible, dramatic gesture it would be. It's not just a gesture. I mean, it's in the spirit, of course, in the spirit of Thomas Jefferson, and could be beautifully designed so that there's something happening at every time of the year. And it would reflect exactly, you know, the season, the moment in time in Washington, D.C. And I think this needs to be a curriculum in the school, and I think we need a symbol at the White House.
Alice, I'd vote for you. And I think it's a great idea. Hey, thank you.
Thanks, Liz.
I wonder if the politicos are going to be smart enough to jump on this idea. The spin potential boggles the mind. Alice Waters is the creator of the Edible Schoolyard program, where students create their own gardens and then cook and eat from them. It's her way of getting young ones around the table together. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. And remember, you can give us a call anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with something to mull over. Americans have more food to eat than any other people on Earth, and more diets to keep them from eating it. The Splendid Table is brought to you by the kitchenware area at Target, where you'll find a complete assortment of fondue sets, including the Trudeau meat and cheese fondue set. This all-purpose fondue item features both a stainless steel meat pot and a stoneware cheese fondue pot in the same set. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. The theme music is by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.